You imagine all these musicians walking into the British Library. We want to learn to do oral history.
When we first started, inside the church was like a forest. I was burying a dead rat. When it gusted over 30 miles an hour, little bits of things would fall down. Because Yoko Ono had curated this, these ladders, basically junk, became art.
Liverpool is a wondrous place.
From Merseybeek to Brookside.
Eric's to the Everyman.
This podcast tells the city's stories.
Whether you're a proper Scouser
or just a day tripper,
listen in to learn something new about Liverpool.
Drawing on the past,
present
and future.
The iconic
and under the radar.
Looking at the people,
places
and moments that make Liverpool what it is.
This
is the National
Museums Liverpool podcast.
Meet you outside the bombed out church is a phrase spoken, texted and hollered down the road routinely on any given week in Liverpool. St Luke's Church, or as it's lovingly known in Liverpool, the bombed out church, is a focal point in the city centre for summer drinks, markets, film screenings and theatre shows, all under open skies. Consecrated in 1831, the church suffered huge damage during the May Blitz of 1941, and the interior and roof structure was almost entirely destroyed. Fast forward to 1965, and the still dilapidated church would often catch the eye of our guest, punk musician Ambrose Reynolds. Ambrose was a key player in the music scene in Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, playing with Oboogie Brothers with Ian Brodie, Big in Japan, Pete Burns' Nightmares on Wax, and forming Dead Birds, Pink Industry, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood with Holly Johnson, before Johnson started a new band by the same name, which went on to great success. But that's a story for another episode. Ambrose is also the sort of person who can go from burying a rat in the grounds of St. Luke's 1 minute to meeting Yoko Ono in the next. A story very much for this episode. Ambrose is known in Liverpool for his experimental spirit and generosity, always looking for the best in people and finding a way to laugh in difficult circumstances. Even in 1965, when he was a young kid, he had a certain curiosity and sensitivity to the world around him, a curiosity that led him to St. Luke's.
I think it would have started when I was a child. My mum had a stall in St. John's Market that was my grandmother's, and she died very suddenly of a stroke in a lot of debt. So my mum took over the stall to pay off my grandmother's debts. And I used to go in, stand on a chair and help to serve. It was baby clothes. It's called Ada's. And everyone in the market was sort of related to each other. You know, they were like distant cousins. So it was a very sort of bonding experience, you know. And we used to get off the bus at St. Luke's, and I'd always like be a bit of a pain in the butt to her and say, well, why is it like that? Why has it got no roof? Who bombed it? Why did they bomb it? So I learned all about Second World War, what my mum had gone through as a child with the air raids, like especially the May Blitz. So I was always quite fascinated with it. You know, why is it like that? And I used to say to her, what about the lovely brides? If it rains, they'll cry. You know, when you're like a kid, you don't really understand.
Safe to say Ambrose was an inquisitive kid, and he even said to his mum that one day he would own the church. But it was years later that the meaning of the building hit home, ironically, across the Atlantic.
Years later, I was on tour with my band Urban Strawberry Lunch, legends in their own lunchtime, and we were at a service station in Spain and we pulled in to get diesel. And I looked up and there was, on the telly behind the bar, there was the Twin Towers. It was September the 11th, 2001. And I saw the smoke coming out the first tower, and then I watched the plane crash into the second tower. And I said to the guy behind the bar, like, you know, que pasa? Kind of, my only Spanish, really. And he said, oh, New York, New York, terror, like that. And I suddenly thought, this kind of horror and uncertainty that when you watch something burn that's been bombed by somebody has a tremendous effect on you. And I thought, well, I've always wanted to do something with St. Luke's. So when I get home, I'm going to find out who owns it and see if I can do something there to commemorate the May Blitz.
Ambrose returned home, determined to do something with the church. But this is a building full of surprises. And when he started out, he found some unexpected residents.
Inside the church was like a forest. There were like bunny rabbits and squirrels and rats, of course. I think the rats are still there. The legend is that they escaped from a lab, or they were rescued from a lab. And so you'd have these rats, and some of them would have like one blue eye and one like pink eye. And it was like a kind of David Bowie rat, you know. But, you know, because I was there every day, not Christmas Day, obviously, but you have to have a day off, don't you? I kind of got to know the rats quite well. And so, you know, when you see a rat, they like scuttle off. And these are just like following me around like little puppies. All right, Dave, how's it going?
Well, it's safe to say no one knows the church as well as you do then.
Yeah, I've been in every single part of it. I've been on the roof of the tower, and the view from up there is amazing. Yeah.
I mean, was it safe to go in there initially? Because it had been derelict, essentially.
Yeah, it's what the council called a managed ruin, which is basically like, we're keeping an eye on it, but... I mean, people have kicked the doors in and stuff like that before I took over. But they've got entropy, which is, it's like a natural force, like gravity. If you don't put energy into something, gradually it starts to disintegrate. To battle the forces of entropy, you have to put energy into it.
If it was energy that the church needed, Ambrose and his band Urban Strawberry Lunch were the people for the job. From 2003, they were regenerating the building through the arts, with a little help along the way.
So the council were great, and property asset management department, a guy called Peter O'Brien, said, oh, that sounds really good. So we put together a sound archive. We did training with the British Library. And you imagine all these musicians walking into the British Library. We want to learn to do oral history. OK. So we interviewed elders in their own homes, in other venues, and a bit in the church as well. And we recorded 135 hours of oral history. And then digitised it all. And to sort of to get more people to be interviewed, we held an event at the church each year on the 5th or 6th of May, or around then, which was the anniversary of when it was bombed, to sort of say, we're here, we're doing stuff with the church, and if you've got a story, we'd love to hear it and add it to our archive. And that sort of built and built, and we started doing exhibitions on the railings, just made of, like, giant A0 photocopies onto MDF boards from Skips. We did workshops with younger people too, teaching them what we'd learned about how to interview, put them into teams of like 3 to 5 people in a team, each with a different responsibility, like one, like your man there, recording it, one interviewing, one with the stopwatch, one thinking of more questions to ask. And we went to St. Michael's Junior School in Egbeth. And they were fantastic. And then we did a secondary school in, I think it was Croxtus. I can't quite remember. It was a long time ago. And then finally we did a kind of youth club one. And they knew nothing. And one of the girls goes, was Hitler bad? So I had to kind of give it the whole history of World War II. Like World War I, World War II, how did this come about? And she was like, oh, I never realised. I mean, there was one of the boys in the junior school. He goes, he's sitting down with this older fella, and he goes, did you see your mates die? And he's like, well, yes, you know, and he's like explaining. Second question, were footballs harder then? And I was like, and I love that. So their interviews on the archive are very, very different from the way an adult would be sensitive, you know, like sometimes you have to stop and let them cry and push pause, you know, yeah. And then you're ready to start. Do you want a glass of water? Yes, please.
Yeah.
Start again.
But then on the flip side of that, I suppose sometimes it's, you kind of need that fresh perspective to maybe talk about the things that maybe other people are scared to go there, or, you know, that's an innocence meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think in today's parlance, and, you know, if it was, say it was NML doing it, you'd have to think about safeguarding and counselling and just all kinds of things. Whereas, you know, if you get basically a bunch of punk rockers who've learned to do it. We have a different approach. So, but you learn to be sensitive to people's feelings and you think that must be so traumatic. Are you sure you're okay? But immensely powerful. As part of the show that we did each year, we started to play excerpts from the sound archive, sometimes with a background of like relevant classical music, like Beethoven or Mozart or Bach. And that was really powerful. The audience would be in tears, you know. And we did one show with in 2005 was Wirral Youth Theatre. We gave them the whole sound archive. And we said, go away, make a narrative from this. And we did workshops with them every week with music, dance, theatre. And they went away and wrote a cracker of a show, which we did inside the church. And that was the first time that anyone had sort of performed in there.
That show was just the beginning of an incredibly creative period for the church, inspired by Ambrose's experience of Liverpool growing up.
The Liverpool that I grew up in had some wonderful places. Like the original Blue Coat was very different to what it is now. There were artists and musicians in the studios above, and they used to have some like quite odd, I mean, Yoko Ono did a thing, didn't she, there with, she covered herself in sugar and flies landed on her and she was in a bag or something, you know. To me, like as a child of the 60s and 70s, that was just like ordinary. Place where I went, I mean, they didn't used to have places like Lipa. If you want to learn to be a musician, you just go to Eric's every night, including Wednesday jazz night. And they were great in there. They just used to let me in and our band, and we used to play there sometimes, even though you had to be 21 to get in. And we were like 15, 16. We looked about 12 as well. Further down Matthew Street, there's a place called the Liverpool School of Music, Dream and Pun that was run by a guy called Peter O'Halligan. Downstairs was like a sort of bazaar. It was called Ant Twackies. And above was a cafe. And they used to put on theatre shows like The Illuminatus, which was Ken Campbell, who's like dead now, but he was an amazing director, and they put this whole show together. Ian Brodie from the Lightning Seeds played guitar in the show and stuff. So, and there was loads going on. And so that was my background as a child, seeing like growing up in the 60s was a kind of blip in the way things are now. Everything's much more regulated. In the 60s, it was like anything you want to do, as long as it doesn't cause a murder, that was kind of okay. I'm quoting Frank Zappa there. So when I got the keys to the church from the council, because they were like, this is great that you're doing stuff with it, keep going. So I was like, okay.
I thought... It's amazing, because you've done quite a lot of work up until that point.
Yeah. When we did the Wirral Youth Theatre show, everyone was writing to them saying, just let them carry on. So there was like a popular force behind it. But I wanted to run the church in a way that was like reflected my background. It's like when you're a writer, you write about what you know. And what I knew was a space that reflected equality, fraternity, and the liberty to do whatever you want, really, to experiment and try things. So we had theatre companies come in. Some were great, some were not so great. And, you know, the not so great one would go, sorry, that was terrible. And I said, well, come back tomorrow and fail better. So, and it was quite often we'd do it on a box office split. So we've got no money to hire. It's fine. We'll pay the costs. We'll hire the lights. We'll get the PA. We'll put the stage in. We'll sell the tickets and then we'll split it 50-50. Factory record style, you know, we'll go down the line together and we'll make this work together. And that was, it was very happy and a lovely thing to do. And when things are like that, you don't get tired. You get more enthusiastic and you get become more inspired to do more stuff. Did all kinds of stuff. We had some people called Freeze, who were like promoters, and they brought in top-notch DJs. I mean, yeah, the Bonobo was amazing. Giles Peterson, you know. Giles Peterson came up to me and said, can I get a selfie with you? And I'm like, what? And he said, no, my little boy saw you on Zingzilla's with your band. And I want to show it to my boy. There were lots of things about the noise and things. And I'm like, well, you know, it's life. life equals noise. And people are saying, oh, it's not appropriate, it's a war memorial. Quite often my pat response would be, okay, yeah, it was destroyed by Hitler. Do you think Hitler would like this music? No. I say, well, there you go, you know. Quite often they come and, I mean, sometimes they get quite drunk, you know, because it's like a club. I mean, a lot of the neighbours go, it's a rave, and it's like, it's not a rave, you know, it's Bonobo. It's like, and they'd sort of go and, like, you'd see them come back a couple of days later with a nan or the mum, and they'd be telling them the history of the church because the information was all around and they'd read it while they were dancing. So it had that, what immediately seems like, oh, that's a bad idea to do something like that, actually had a very positive impact because they would come back and they'd bring their family and they'd tell them about it. And so it would get people talking about the war, about the Blitz, about life, about your experiences.
The church at this time embraced the full spectrum of life, something Ambrose never shied away from.
A lot of the problem with the church, because when I ran it, the gardens were open every day, except Christmas Day, obviously, because I'd be opening presents. Yeah. So you get like a lot of homeless guys coming in, homeless men, homeless women, who'd be sleeping in tents or, you know, there'd be a woman in a cardboard box selling her body for heroin, you know, and that's deeply upsetting. And to me, the whole ethos when I ran it was of equality, of a fraternity. And the chance, it's like, well, have you got any hobbies? What did you used to do before you went on the streets? So we worked with the Fab Collective, who are a group of photographers, and we worked with a group of homeless people and street drinkers, heroin addicts, taught them photography, gave them like okay-ish digital cameras, you know, kind of did the job. Sent them out with one of the group, one of the Fab Collective and a homeless person. And we go out and we just shoot the city. We just photograph everything, come back to the church, go through it, put all the good ones on a hard drive. So you might have like 100 really awful, blurry, terrible pictures. But then you get one that was like, wow, how did you get that? Oh, well, I mean, it was the mankiest stray cat in the world. And this guy had like got down on the floor, so the cat was looking down on him. It was an amazing photo. So we put the exhibition up, put the sort of low-tech one on the railings with the photocopies, the giant photocopies. And inside we did the posh colour ones printed on waterproof boards. So we'd get a lot of tourists and visitors come in and they go, this photography exhibition is incredible. Who's the artist? So like, see that guy over there, and it'd be like a drunk, you know, with a can of cider. I said, it's him. Once we had Lady McIntosh of the Roundtree McIntosh family come in, lovely young woman. And she said, oh, I want to buy them. So she like bought loads of them. So that somewhere in a stately home, there's a picture of a monkey stray cat looking down on someone. To me, that was all part of it, to give people a chance. One day I was in the church. It was just before biennial 2007, or maybe, yeah, 2007. And I was burying a dead rat, as you do. Well, I mean, what are you going to do with it? You call the council. It's like, we'll come by next month. And it's like, oh, no. So I was like, I'm burying this rat. And I get this tap on the shoulder and this like, excuse me. And I turned around and kind of looked, couldn't see anyone, looked down. And it was Yoko Ono. And I'm like, all right, girl. Kind of a bit of a shock. She said, can I show my work here? And I went, yeah. And then I just carried on digging. Play it cool with celebs, you know. So, you know, whether it's a millionaire living in New York or a woman living in a cardboard box, treat them the same respect.
Yoko Ono went on to create the art exhibition Liverpool Skyladders Inside the Church for the 2008 Liverpool Biennial, the year Liverpool was the UK's European capital of culture.
Originally, it was called Skyladders for John, which is quite a romantic sort of title. And then she kind of went away and came back and said, it's just called Skyladders. We had all these like not the straight up ladders, but the ones, I realise I'm on audio here, but it's like an A shape. But she put out a call and people would bring ladders in when we were having open days or things were going on. You know, there's a rave and an old man turns up with his 1950s stepladder. And City Council went crackers.
Oh my God, yeah.
Health and safety. And I was just like, oh no. I was just like, well, no one's going to climb up them, you know. The whole thing with the sky ladders for John was, do you know the story about how they met? John Lennon, when he was in the Beatles, was in New York. He went to this exhibition that Yoko put on. He didn't know her. She had an installation of ladders. This is before health and safety legislation. All these ladders with little tiny messages pinned to the ceiling. So John Lennon climbs up this ladder and he goes and he reads it and it says, yes. So he comes down the ladder and asks her out on a date. So that's why it had this whole sort of romantic connotation in a church that's open above us only sky. It all kind of interconnects, you know. So that was, you know, that really appealed to me, that whole ethos of it, you know. Gradually, as the biennial sort of wore on, we had more and more ladders. So eventually it was absolutely full of ladders. You had these manky old ladders that people would basically just getting rid of. At the end of it, a team of technicians came up in a massive, like, proper art removal van, you know, like it was a Van Gogh or a Picasso. And they very carefully wrapped each ladder in bubble wrap, like several times, like it was the Mona Lisa, labelled it, did a little, like, note on the clipboard, like, you know, ladder 4 foot wood. And they took it off to another gallery somewhere in the world, I'm not sure where it was exhibited. Wow. As art. But because Yoko Ono had curated this, these ladders, basically junk, became art.
Perception is a funny thing, but Ambrose took care across every facet of the church, down to the last critical stone.
As you pointed out before, it was in a bad state of repair. I became a bit sort of obsessive with wind speed and checking the wind, how windy is it today, and worked out when it gusted over 30 miles an hour, little bits of things would fall down. If it had snowed and then it thawed 3 days later, bits would fall off. So you kind of learn to read the building. I was sort of it as like this grand old lady that used to be really gorgeous and still is, but she's an old lady. To sort of personify her, you know, made it easier to do. So I'd have to monitor what the weather was doing. And so that gets you very in tune with nature, you know. The pond in the middle would always have these amazing birds would come and just drink, you know, as well as the seagulls. They come and you're all part of nature within there. I mean, stuff like Midsummer Night's Dream was, you know, was great in there, you know. So if it was too windy, we wouldn't open. So we had the Kooks playing there, like quite a big band. I'd never heard of them.
Was that when they were big then?
Yeah, they were like on the ascendant. And they were doing two nights because it's a small venue, really. So the second night, and I'm saying, oh, it's looking windy, like that, to the production manager. And we're standing on the stage. And he said, oh, it's nothing like that. As he was speaking, an enormous piece of masonry landed in between us and smashed on the stage. And he went, you know what you're talking about, don't you? I was like, well, yeah. I've been here a long time. Let's bump it. It's fine tomorrow. Let's just bump it a day. Oh, I said, it's an unusual venue. It has unusual requirements, but the benefits outweigh those shortfalls.
No doubt the building was special, but in 2014, a few factors led to some reflection from Ambrose. Amongst funding cuts and the introduction of new policy for community assets, his band split up. And if that weren't enough, there was a massive storm.
I was thinking, well, for this to be really viable, and why am I here? I'm here to protect the building. That's first and foremost, is make sure that she's okay, you know, as a building. So one of our volunteers was an architect, and she got in touch with a friend of hers at English Heritage, or Historic England, as it's known now. She gave me their details, and I started talking, and they said, oh, we speak to the council and they don't answer the emails, they don't answer the calls, we set up meetings and they don't show up. We've got funding. They'll have to match it, but we've got funding. So I was like, oh, okay. So I phoned up my contact in the council and I said, oh, I've got these like wacky guys and they want to give you some money for the church, but did not say English Heritage. Just said, these wacky guys, can you come down tomorrow? We'll have a cup of tea and just, it might be worth your while. So he turns up with the clipboard, you know, and we were sat at a table and I said, such and such from, I won't say his name because it's not fair. This is Charles from English Heritage. This is such and such, this is such and such. And he just looked at me. Can you beep or can I swear? He went, I'll just say it. He went, your B word. And I just thought, well, you know, they've been trying to get in touch. Just get it together. Do you want tea or coffee? I said, coffee. I said, I'll leave you to it.
They raised £500,000 and put out a bid for people to do the work.
Steve the stonemason, I used to call him, won the bid and he fell in love with the building. And he did all of this, lots of extra work, just because he wanted to. Duggan and Parr, I think they were called. And they did a whole stabilisation over a long, like a year or so. I still had a sneaky check and my wife's going, are you checking the weather? No. So that for me, that was like a major milestone. It's like, for now, the building is stabilised. Then there was the whole, we had to do an expression of interest bid to officially get the building, because when I was running it was under the Lib Dems and they wouldn't spend any money on it, but they'd sort of let me do what I want. When Labour came in, it was, you have to run it past us, you have to do this, you have to work with Culture Company. I'm like, okay, whatever, you know, let's make this work. But they put the money in. People are critical of Joe Anderson, but he did put his hand in his pocket to, you know, source it out. It's always going to be owned by the council. I mean, I do the lottery and, you know, maybe I'll buy it. But I never won, so.
With the money came strings, a level of management which didn't always sit easily alongside the ideals with which Ambrose had overseen the church. For one thing, they insisted he have a commercial partner.
Truth be told, it all kind of went downhill from there because it lost that sort of the spark and the joy was fading. And I kept going for 3 years and then COVID hit. And my idea was to reach out to the homeless guys, get them through the pandemic, keep them alive. It's a life and death situation. My business partner started putting picnic benches in there. And I was like, what are you doing? And we had sort of polar opposite ideas of what it should be and how it should be and why are we here, you know. And it lost that, you know, the three foundations that I'd sort of built it upon.
It's easy to hear this and think that the spirit Ambrose brought to the church was lost. But this story is nothing if not one of resilience, even in the face of war and destruction. St. Luke's is still standing strong today. And if it weren't for the years of work Ambrose, Urban Strawberry Lunch and the community put in, it very easily wouldn't be. Instead, it's become a landmark in the city, a place that's united generations, helped build empathy across communities, and always known how to throw a good party.
I mean, we had the first wedding there since the 50s. People used to get married in the vestry in the 50s. But we had the sort of first modern wedding and it was a Chinese girl and a English fella, Scouse Chinese, and she wore red. I just loved it. I mean, I always had quite a Chinese influence in there, you know, like Chinese New Year was always like the craziest day of the year, you know, we'd just be full of people. And 2017, my daughter got married in there.
Did she?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you must be so proud of the legacy that you've left.
Yeah, we were all crying. So when I think back to the church, I mean, to me, the raves, the exhibitions, the archive, for me, the highlight of it is walking my daughter down the aisle, you know, and it didn't rain. It was like today. It was gorgeous day. You know, the gods were with us.
It seemed the energy Ambrose put into the church bounced back onto the ceremony that day. In his time, the church went from a blight to a beacon of healing, community and creativity, and today one of the key places on any visitor's map. A big thank you to Ambrose for sharing his extraordinary tales with the church. This podcast was hosted by Megan McGurk, that's me. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to the National Museum's Liverpool podcast for more Liverpool stories, from the under the radar to the truly iconic.